You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 22nd, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Brian Grimm of the Huffington Post, on a story he's been covering for quite some time. The head of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission pushed out by the nuclear industry. Isn't that wonderful? It's not like none of these nuclear plants ever have huge, disastrous failures that could cause radiation poisoning. That's not on the table, so we don't have to worry about that. Also on the program today, more on Cory Booker. You're never going to guess who some of his biggest funders are. And good news for those people who were upset that you weren't having an opportunity to be propagandized to the extent that foreign nations are by the Department of Defense. Well, that's about to change. Again, we will get to that story about the Republicans attacking the census. And why? Well, of course, provides data. And that is against God's wishes. God doesn't like data. And apparently, according to this pastor at the Providence Road Baptist Church, God don't like the gays. He's against it. Totally against it. And great story in the New York Times outlining how states are now essentially funding religious schools, private schools, through a backdoor voucher system. Get to that Heartland story, which I've been teasing, I guess, for 2 days now, that heartwarming story of Heartland. Before we do today, and also I've got some great clips of Rush Limbaugh being absolutely creepy, and then just weird. Weird and creepy, and a great clip of Fox and Friends advocating more shame for poor people. Because, of course, I don't know. It's gotten so crazy, folks. I don't know what to tell you. But here is a moment of policy. I have said this many times before, but I have never seen it presented this data. Of course, God's against gay data, so forgive me if I am struck down by lightning in the course of telling you this story. The Atlantic, and we will link to this on our site, because this is a very important, it's a very important data point, and it's, I've never seen it broken down in this way, and also presented in graphic form. The Urban Institute researcher Richard Johnson started to run the numbers. I've talked in the past about how traditionally 90% of the nation's income basically was subject to the Social Security tax. Wherever the cap was, whether it was at 106,000, 110,000, 100,000, 95,000, going back through time and down, 90% of Americans' income ran through that. But because of the tremendous amount of wealth disparity, because so few people have so much of the money, that percentage has dropped down to about 83, 82, 81%, depending on whose stats you use. And that 7 or 8% shortfall, or I should say that 7 or 8% uncaptured tax on income, is what contributes to a major part of the shortfall in Social Security, starting, of course, in 2033, 34, where Social Security will only be able to pay out 75% of benefits. And it will be able to do that until I am just a sack of worms. Maybe not even that. Maybe I'll be fully composted at that point. Unless, of course, I live to about 110. Possible. So this researcher, Richard Johnson, broke down the numbers on how much income, what percent of the income generated in a specific county is subject to the Social Security tax. On the counties that contribute the least to Social Security as a share of local earnings, the number one place in the country, the number one county, now think in terms of income disparity, folks, and you will be able to guess this, is Manhattan. New York, New York, 47.7% of the income earned in Manhattan is subject to the Social Security tax. Compare this with the Bronx. I'm talking the Isle of Manhattan. Compare that with the Bronx. 94.4% of all the income generated in the Bronx is subject to the Social Security tax. So you understand what you have here is that you have so much money that is being made over $110,000 by specific individuals in Manhattan, that fully 50%, more than 50% of the income generated is above that amount. Whereas in the Bronx, almost only 6% of the income generated there is generated by an individual getting paid more than $110,000 a year. And so you can guess from there, the number two county or borough, I guess, or town in the country that is subject to is Queens at 92.6%. So you see what's going on here in Manhattan or New York. Number two, in terms of least amount of income subject to the Social Security tax as a share of the income generated there, Fairfield, Connecticut, 49%. Westchester, New York, 59%. San Mateo, California. I would presume that's outside of San Francisco or somewhere around there. I don't know. Lake Illinois, that's a suburb of Chicago, I would guess. It's where basically everybody goes to live when you have the money. You go into the city and you move out. Contra Costa, California. Fulton, Georgia, which I imagine is near Atlanta. And so you got a lot of those soda executives, Coca-Cola and what other companies. Suffolk, Massachusetts, which must be where a lot of the people, but that's 69%. I mean, you're back up to 69%. So really, I mean, you got to be looking at New York and Fairfield. And then San Francisco is at 70%, Norfolk, Mass, 70%. So you see what we have here, the problem that we have, is that there's just too much money in the hands of too few individuals to not raise the cap on Social Security. If you raise the cap on Social Security, virtually no one in the Bronx will pay more money to Social Security than they do now. If you lift the cap on Social Security, fully half the people in Manhattan will then pay more in Social Security. We will link that on our blog at majority.fm. Now we got to take a break. We'll be talking to Ryan Grimm briefly about this story. Very interesting story. I've seen very little coverage of it outside of Ryan Grimm. We'll be right back after this. On the phone, are you Washington Bureau Chief of the Huffington Post, Ryan?
I am. Can you believe that?
I can. Absolutely. Of course. There's actually, I would have been shocked had you said no.
Oh.
I couldn't imagine who that would be.
Right. Who else? Who else?
No, there's no one else. It's Sam Stein? No way.
I mean, that'd be chaos.
That would be absolutely, it would be beyond the limits of what is not offensive. Ryan Grimm, the Washington Bureau Chief of the Huffington Post. I also got to tell you before we get into this NRC story, because you've been on this beat, this NRC thing for months, as far as I can tell. I have seen virtually nothing written about it anywhere else. So I wanted to talk to you about that. I also, Friday afternoon, I heard you on a Hannity show.
No, you were listening to Hannity?
Yes, on occasion I will dip in to see what the least talented guy in radio is doing.
What do you think?
It was pretty funny let me see if I recall this. Hannity had you on with some right winger, I can't remember who it was, and he was complaining about how this story of Mitt Romney bullying kids was getting play, but people weren't promoting the fact that. That Obama had used drugs when he was and the best part was like he was waiting for you to sort of come out. I don't know, you know, he's got such a one-dimensional approach to everything. You came out and said, well, I got to be honest with you, I don't have a problem with him using drugs. So I think, he should really be talking about it more. And Hannity just was
he didn't quite know what to do with that.
Okay, but and then he went to the right winger like, don't you? And then he started saying like, what? He was upset that you didn't have a problem with drugs, and then all he could say is, I like Ariana.
Right. Yes. And he actually then had some kind words for the Huffington Post.
Yeah.
That it was leans left, but it's fair. That thing spiraled totally out of control.
Yeah, that didn't. That was one of those segments where I'm sure he was just sort of like, "Well, Ryan's nice, but I don't know that we can use him. I want a specific. I want to know exactly what he's going to say before he comes on again."
Yeah,
but it was fun to hear him sort of like get completely confused by what you were saying.
The other argument that I made to him was that I thought that he was actually probably lying about his drug use. And he was like, why on earth would he do that? And I said, well, he's trying to create an arc of redemption.
Right, that, right. You know, that was the part that completely threw him. You said, let me just say, now I remember, he said to you, like, you know, he said all this stuff about the drug use. And you said, you thought that he was sort of hyping it, that he actually, based upon interviews with people who knew Obama at that time, they don't think that he used as much drugs as he claimed to use. But he was sort of saying it to make his story more dramatic.
Yeah. And then the right wing guy actually was like, yeah, that kind of makes some sense.
Right.
So it was total chaos.
Oh, okay. Now this is all coming back to me because this was in the context of that brochure. Now, the funny thing is that it didn't come up, but that the whole book, or at least the book that it was promoting, talks about him being born in Hawaii.
And I wasn't really that well briefed on. I mean, I had no idea what we were going to talk about when I went on, and I didn't really follow that story closely, but you're right. I would doubt that he even saw that brochure, and if he did, maybe just looked the other way and was like, whatever, these are just idiot PR people.
Absolutely.
I'm not gonna bother myself with them. You've dealt with plenty of PR people to know that like an error like that could easily be slipped in.
I got to say that when we were working on the book that Stephen Sherrill and I wrote back in the day, the only thing the publisher seemed to care about was the book cover. And, like, literally, yeah. You know, the old story, don't judge a book by its cover. Apparently, that's the only thing that happens.
Yes, that's right.
And
yeah, when I saw my PR stuff for my book, I was like, yeah, half this is wrong. How much am I going to fight them on?
Exactly. The bureaucracy was crazy. But, you know, who knows? But it was just, I thought it was pretty funny. All right. So let's go into the story about the NRC. Give me some background on this. Gregory, how do you pronounce his last name?
Yazko.
He has basically tendered his resignation. Who is he, and why is this important to those of us who do not want to be subject to radiation poisoning?
Right. So he is the outgoing Nuclear Regulatory Commission chairman, and he's one of these guys who's worked in just the public interest field his whole life. He's a physicist or nuclear physicist or something like that. And then he worked in Harry Reid's office for a while before heading to the commission, where he's been for at least 7 years. And he was the reason that I started looking at this actually is that in December, Darrell Issa on a Friday evening dropped this report saying that. That Gregory Yazko was like being abusive towards his female staffers, and he's a tyrant, and he's a lunatic, and you know he's just heavy-handed, and he ought to go, and that these four commissioners, his four other commissioners, are coming after him, and I've never met Gregory Yazko, but I actually had met his wife, who is a Hill reporter, and she's been up on the Hill for. At least 5 years, and so I'd known her for a long time, we're not like personal friends, but I knew that she was not somebody who'd be married to a guy who was abusive to women and a tyrant like this. So I said, there's something else going on here.
I can't believe you would be skeptical of Darrell Issa, and because we know how in Congress and amongst these halls, the idea of total respect for women is sacrosanct.
Right. So they had it well orchestrated, though, because they had two Democratic commissioners and two Republicans on this letter attacking Yazko. So, for the mainstream media, they see that and they're like, oh, God, they've got both sides here.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, there can't be another story because you have your Democrats say and your Republicans say. But if you look at it from the lens of, well, there's corporate and public interest, then you still do come up with two sides to the story.
Right. And, this guy's got two strikes against him. I mean, for someone who has spent his entire career in public service and also a scientist, you know there's something going on here with this guy. There's obviously a real problem. I mean, you got to get those type of people out of the regulatory business because they don't have the industry best interest in mind. And so basically, so tell us about the other four. You got two Democrat and two Republicans. How deep in the pockets of the industry are these four people?
Very deep. And so the Republicans, you can just assume like, hey, if we can get this chairman out, we'll get him out. That's kind of a given. What the industry needed was to get the Democrats on board, and so there were two of them. One of them is just kind of a very go-along commissioner. The other is this guy, Bill Magwood, who, as I dug into it, I found out that he'd been going in and out of the private sector between his government jobs, but he had actually done paid consulting for the company that owns Fukushima. So nice work there.
Right. That's not a conflict of interest in any way, is it?
No, not at all. And here he is trying to delay post-Fukushima safety rules. And the other wild thing that I found, and this came because of a reader email after the first story that I wrote, this wasn't the first time that Bill Magwood had pulled this off. In the in the 1990s, he had been the number two guy at the Department of Energy. And he started working with the Hill and with the media to undermine his boss, who was this guy named Terry Lash, who was the same kind of guy. He'd been at, I think, NRDC and had only done, he was, Al Gore was his patron. He had only done kind of public interest work. And he kind of like flagged him for moving some money in a way that bureaucrats always move money, but they raised a stink about it, and then the Republicans in Congress demanded his resignation, and eventually he resigned, and Magwood took his job before leaving to go into lobbying and consulting, and then back to the NRC. So watching this play out again, you know, that made me that much more skeptical of the claims that he was making, because what are the chances that, you know, for two times in a row that he's gonna be underneath a tyrant, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, both of these guys have impeccable reputations, the Terry Lash and Gregory Yasko, and you know, their coworkers speak extremely highly of them. It's the industry that hasn't been fans of them.
Now, who is Magwood's patron? I mean, how does this guy keep moving in and out of the regulatory bodies and then working for the industry? I mean, how is this guy a paid consultant for Fukushima and still sitting on the Nuclear Regulatory Commission? I mean, that seems to me to be problematic. That seems almost fairly obvious.
Well, I think the problem is that I think his patron was Pete Rouse. That's the most that I've been able to suss out. Who was a former White House official. The problem here is that a lot of people in the Obama administration are very close to big nuclear because they're from Chicago and because Exelon is such a huge nuclear power player in that state. The only reason that Yasko was able to make it onto the commission is because Harry Reid demanded it. It was Harry Reid's kind of price for supporting Obama. He supported Obama very early on. He's an extreme opponent of using Yucca Mountain as a waste depository. Yasko is also an opponent of that, and Reid very much wanted him on. Reid backed Obama. Obama won. Reid gets Yasko. I mean, that's basically how this worked. But for the rest of the seats, it went more according to the traditional administration playbook, where you have you know, the nuclear industry fairly cozy with them.
And they have really done a job on any type of tightening of regulation in the wake of Fukushima, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, they've just fought him every inch of the way in his efforts to tighten safety standards. It's obviously not a very far-sighted strategy, but you know, it's just seems reflexive.
And so what happens now? I mean, the amazing thing is like, I've read your piece on it, and then the only other thing I could find on it, I think, was in the Washington Post. And it basically just says it was, you know, three short paragraphs. The departure of Yasko, an advocate of tough safety standards at nuclear reactor sites during 8 years on the NRC, caps almost a year of concerns about his leadership at the NRC. though frequently at odds with fellow NRC commissioners over the extent of safety requirements. I mean, it's sort of just like hinting at, like, it may have something to do with the fact that he wants safety requirements. It was political timing and management style that ultimately prompted his departure. And supposedly there's a draft of a report showing that he made female staffers cry by certain comments. This is really how it all works. I mean, this is like a sad episode of Veep.
Yeah, it really is. That's why I invested kind of a disproportionate amount of time digging into this, because because it's so revealing about the way that things work here. What's really interesting is that it shows, you know, when you think of the way that money corrupts the system, you think about, okay, I'll give this person money and they will do this thing for me. But it works the other way, too. If they refuse to do what I want them to do, then I will destroy them. And not just destroy them politically, like, hey, you're not going to get reconfirmed because we're going to filibuster you. But I will destroy you personally. No, I will accuse you of being abusive to women so that it's repeated in all these newspaper articles. And then, you know, if you look at other stories about his resignation, they all say that, like, you know, amid concerns about his treatment of women. And,
yep.
And it's completely 100% made up, but it doesn't matter. You know, it does its damage. Now, I guess thankfully for him, there's now kind of at least a bit of an alternative media out there that will tell a different story. You know, a bunch of other folks, you know, linked to my story and did some digging in it. So at least there's that out there, which Terry Lash in the 90s didn't have to benefit from. But it's just got to be a terrible experience to go through. And it's not just for him. It's a public warning to anybody else who wants to get into public life and not toe the industry line. Like, this is what could happen to you. You don't necessarily have to do anything wrong, and we will paint you as like this monster in the press.
And of course this story not just functions as one about sort of a cautionary tale of being not corrupt on these regulatory bodies, but it also is it sets off some alarm bells because it's not like, you know, you got Indian Point is sitting on a fault line apparently that they weren't aware of when they built it, and so maybe it's not really built to withstand that. I mean, these are, you have tens of miles, square miles in Japan that, you know, maybe probably not in our lifetime will ever be inhabitable. And that's, mm-hmm. We have still, reactor number 4 still could be problematic, is my understanding. Mm-hmm. And so this is not... this is not like, well, we've managed to get rid of somebody on the county commission, to make sure that where building supplies go for, where we're going to buy our sand when we fix the roads. This is pretty big. Who is going to replace him? I mean, is there any sense? Is there somebody? Do we have any confidence that somebody's going to replace them that is going to fight for stricter regulation, particularly in the wake of Fukushima? Or is this basically this body just useless?
Well, for one, it certainly isn't a very appealing job for somebody who is inclined to tightly regulate the industry, is it? I mean, after watching what they did to this guy, if the president called you and said, hey, how'd you like to be chairman of the NRC? It's like, geez, thanks, but no thanks. I think I prefer my anonymity to being like written about in the Times as abusive towards women. But on the other hand, there is a bit of a kind of a reverse coup that I think Yasko pulled here. So as you hinted at, they're still going after him. They're concocting quote unquote reports, and they'll give them to ISA, and ISA will blast them out and hold hearings and. Yada, yada, yada. Now all of that is completely defanged. Good luck, ISA, trying to pitch to a reporter, how terrible this NRC chairman is, because the reporter will just say, well, this guy announced his resignation, enough. And so he's not out actually until June of 2013. And the chairman of the NRC has a lot of power. He can act without necessarily the approval of the rest of the commissioners. And so I think at NEI, which is the big nuke lobby shop, I think they probably celebrated for about 5 minutes and then were like, huh, now what? Then they realize that this guy is now in office for possibly another 14, 15 months with a completely free hand. And and the media is not going to go along with their little circus against him, and he doesn't have to really listen to them anymore. He can now just try to implement, the various safety regulations that he can get in place between now and then. And then it would be up to the new commissioners to try to get rid of them, which is always hard. It's much easier publicly to stall things than it is to repeal things, because repealing safety regulation makes for bad headlines. So this all depends. He's resigning pending a successor, the confirmation of a successor. You know, judging from how the Senate moves, at a pace of what, one nominee per year or so, there's a good chance that he'll serve out his entire term. Especially as contentious as this is, if it goes through, say, the July recess, I doubt they're going to come back in the fall and appoint somebody, which would mean it would be kicked over into the new year. New year, they're dealing with all the debt ceiling and payroll tax cut stuff.
Right, and Reid, theoretically, at least until January, Reid is in charge of the schedule, so he can slow. It seems to me that he could prevent at least a vote until January.
Oh, absolutely. He can block. It is his premier issue. I asked Mary Landrieu once if there's anything that Reid had said to her, like, look, I really need this personally. I need you to vote with me on this. And she said that, yes, Yucca Mountain. She said something like he's a tiger and that Yucca Mountain is his cub. Like, he opposes it that much. And so even if he loses the Senate, he'll still have 40-plus Democrats, and so he'd be able to filibuster, if Republicans don't blow up the filibuster, any pro-industry nominee or pro-Yucca nominee, because I think that's more where his focus is.
So wait, so Ryan, this turns out to be a hopeful story, because it seems to me that Yasko basically did a jujitsu move on these guys. He knew he wasn't going to get reappointed in June of 2013, because there was just too much headwinds, and so he basically takes the steam out of this blockbuster report that's going to come out and say that he had some comments that made somebody cry.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that he punked them pretty good on this. It's still, a horrible thing for him to go through, but he beat back the coup. The coup came in October, November, December, and he went to the hearings, and he did not resign. The White House stood by him, and Democrats stood by him, which was key. Because that didn't happen in the 90s with Terry Lash. The Democrats kind of just didn't feel like caring about it. I think the Fukushima revelations about Magwood helped him a lot by focusing it on industry versus public interest. And so he survived that to get to this point. And now I think you're right. It's a nice little jujitsu move where he's like, look, now I have the next year plus, where I can basically just operate in the public interest, do what I think is right, and then I'm done. Because you're right, there's zero chance he was getting past a Republican filibuster in June. That just was never going to happen.
Well, fascinating stuff. Great reporting. I've been watching you write about this for months now, and you're the only one who was really on top of this. So thank you.
Well, thanks, man.
All right, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. Thanks, Ryan.
Yep, thank you.
Let's do one more story before we go, because this is just let's play this audio of Rush Limbaugh. Now, you've seen reports Rush Limbaugh's ratings are down in a lot of places. He's certainly lost millions of dollars in advertising because of his problems with women. And I think his problems with women have been well documented in the past years, but it really struck a chord with people when he was starting to call women who were testifying in front of Congress sluts for doing so. And but it seems as if he's still a little bit tone deaf. I'm not talking about being deaf because of all the Oxycontin he abused over the years. Hillbilly heroin if you're a hillbilly heroin addict, the chances of you losing your hearing, I guess, goes way up. But I'm pretty sure he heard what he was saying here, because you can see him repeat it. Here he is, perhaps in one of the creepiest times I've ever seen Rush, where he basically encourages, you listen to his response to this 14-year-old girl. And you tell me if this isn't the creepiest. Now, you have to imagine Rush Limbaugh sitting there on wife number three. This is the guy who's famous for taking all that Viagra to the Dominican. I don't think it was one of those like charity things. I don't think it's like, well, I'm bringing a whole bunch of like jeans or canned food. No, I think he was taking that Viagra down there. Not sure why, but I'm sure if you Google things like sex tourism in the Dominican, you might come up with some answers. But here he is responding to a 14-year-old girl, welcoming her into the fold, as it were, almost like those wilding guys on Game of Thrones, you know, with his own daughters. Well, God bless.
So let's go to Katie, Island Park, Idaho. Glad you called. Great to have you on the program. Hello.
Hi, Rush. Yeah, my name is Katie, and I'm 14, and I'm not sure if I qualify to be a Rush baby or a Rush babe. What do you think?
You're 14?
I'm 14.
All right, pause it.
You're both.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're going to have to go back just a sec. You're 14, so he clearly hears what she's saying. Is she a Rush baby or a Rush babe? Well, let's hear what he says.
You're 14?
I'm 14.
You're both.
Ooh.
You are a Rush baby and a Rush babe both. We'll count you both.
All righty.
Buzz.
Have you signed?
Even the 14-year-old is freaked out by this. She's like, wait a second. I'm both a baby and a babe. In other words, I'm young enough to be a baby, but hot enough to be someone who could be one of your babes.
I love how he confirms that she's 14, as if 13 would have been no way.
But the thing is that, like, even if he had said, like, you're a Rush babe because you're 14, I think she would have been okay. But the fact that you can be both simultaneously, I think, is what creeped her out. Keep playing it.
On our Facebook page?
Yes, I just did this morning.
Well, then you're a Rush babe. That's it.
Hey.
14. Well, thanks very much, Katie. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rush.
See, folks, this program has no boundaries.
Oh, yes, indeed it does not. And I would bet that as Rush Limbaugh goes to break, you'll hear a little clicking as he's like, let me check out this Rush babe baby's pick. So there it is, folks, your moment of absolute horrid disgustingness brought to you by Rush Limbaugh today. But in the better half of the program, we'll have more. And also in the better half of the program, anti-gay university, anti-gay preacher, what do they have in common? They're both anti-gay in a horrible way. And we'll also, I think, in the better half of the program, listen to what Rush Limbaugh has to say about organic food. How demented he is. We'll also hear a clip of the Fox and Friends people talking about how poor people need to be shamed more. That is their problem. They're not ashamed of themselves enough. They just want to eat things like that. They want to eat and do stuff, but they really need more shame. Folks, this program, unlike the programs where guys like Cory Booker and Ed Rendell go on and espouse their corporateness in the guise of being liberals, unlike those programs that slough off the notion of cutting Social Security for people, this program, unlike those that see their jobs as just being a cheerleader for Barack Obama, can't seem to sort of present the reality of our government, but at the same time also acknowledge that Mitt Romney's worse than Obama. This program relies almost exclusively on your support. Can't do it without your support. Won't do it without your support. Need your support. Don't know how else to... To say that, you can support this show by becoming a member at majority.fm. And if you can't bring yourself to pay 10 bucks a month, even though you're paying whatever, 100 bucks a month for cable, $60 a month for cable, $190 for cable. And you're paying, I don't know, whatever you're paying for whatever else you do. I don't know. At the very least, you should donate your account to us at donateyouraccount.com. Our guy Kyle set up that system. It is now being used by the Obama campaign. It is being used by the Occupy people. It is, and sadly, it's being used by Citizens Radio, who have more accounts than us. And so please donate it. You won't feel bad that you did. Trust me. And on top of that, you can buy your junk through our Amazon link if you buy Amazon crap. We have merchandise, justcoffee.coop. I get so many emails saying, why would people who drink coffee not buy justcoffee.coop? We now have a Majority Report blend. Do you still get a 10% discount with the coupon code Majority? I believe so. And go in, buy that coffee. It's delicious coffee. If you drink coffee, there's no reason for you not to buy this coffee. It's fair trade. It's organic. It's a co-op. You win, I win, they win. How many things in your life are win-win-win? Nothing. Nothing else. And, of course, give us a review on iTunes. You can join this program at 646-257-3920 in the better half. Had a lot of callers yesterday. You can IM at Majority FM. And, yes, I welcome conservative callers. I know that we have a couple. I get a couple people tweeting me. I'm a libertarian. Can I call in? I'm a conservative. Are you a conservative who eats organic food? These people are so stupid. It's just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable.
They don't know what you're talking about yet. You'll find out in the better half.
Well, conservatives know what I'm talking about.
The organic food bit.
Oh, no, but I'm saying they know what it means when I say that they're unbelievably not intelligent.
Oh, okay.
All right, folks, see you in the better half.